we should try to encourage democracy where we can. And we should recognize that in the long run, our security, our values, our ability to live as we wish will be seriously undermined if virtually every other country in the world starts to be a dictatorship.
Hello and welcome to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. My name is Indy, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Julia. After the fall of the Soviet Union, it seemed that there was no end in sight for the growth of liberal democracy. The end of history was here, and global democracy was a dream that had finally come true. In 2022, we know that this is far from the reality of the state of democracy around the world. Over the last several years, we have witnessed a trend of democratic backsliding, as populist and authoritarian candidates in the Americas, Europe, Asia, and elsewhere have moved liberal democracies towards increasingly authoritarian regimes. Although the Biden administration has made promises to fight to uphold democracy abroad, these trends continue. What do the administration's efforts actually look like, and has the Biden administration delivered on the promises it has made? Joining us today to answer these questions and more is Professor Yasha Monk.
Yasha Monk is one of the world's leading experts on the crisis of liberal democracy and the rise of populism. He is an associate professor of the practice of international affairs at Johns Hopkins University, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, the founder of Persuasion, and a host of the Good Fight podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs.
All right, Professor Monk, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
My pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
So just to start us off with a pretty broad question. So broadly speaking, how has the state of democracy around the world changed since the end of the Cold War? And how is it different than was envisioned after the fall of the Soviet Union?
So the end of the Cold War was a time of great democratic hopes and democratic expansion. Many countries around the world, which had been autocracies, which mostly had been communist dictatorships, but not only, were starting to establish new democratic institutions. There was hope that many of these countries would really succeed in establishing those democratic institutions. And there was the famous idea expressed by Francis Fukuyama in The End of History, which I'm sure many listeners to this podcast will have been assigned in one class or another, which never argued that history would end, that there would no longer be historical events, but which did argue that liberal democracy had achieved a kind of hegemony of legitimacy, that there really didn't seem to be any particularly realistic competitors to this political system that could make a claim to being legitimate, being desirable, though it have mass support. For a few years, it looked as though this was broadly right. Through the beginning of the 1990s, more countries democratized. That was a messy process, as it always has been, but it looked pretty promising, especially in countries like Poland, for example, or Hungary in Central Europe, which had been part of the Eastern Bloc, which had been ruled by these communist dictatorships, and which seemed to be doing very well at establishing democratic institutions. But what's happened over the last 15 or 16 years is what Larry Diamond has called a democratic recession. So for each of the last 15 years, and I'm telling something new here when I report that it's for each of the last 16 years, because there's a new report by Freedom House coming out in the next days, which shows that this democratic recession is ongoing, more countries have moved away from democracy than have moved towards it, which is to say that in each of these years, the number of countries which have experienced democratic backsliding has been bigger than the number of countries that have consolidated their democracies or tried to establish democratic institutions anew. And this is partially what we might think of as a reverse wave. So it's partially that some of the countries that tried to establish democratic institutions in the early 1990s did not succeed in doing that, and these fledgling democracies fell to dictatorships, which is tragic, but not really surprising from the point of view of political science. That happened with previous democratic waves in the 19th century and in the early 20th century as well. But it is also that democratic institutions in countries where political scientists long took their stability for granted have started to look rather weak, rather brittle. It is also that today in the public discourse in the United States, people talk all of the time about a threat to American democracy in a way they would not have done 10 years ago. And that to me is what makes this historical moment particularly perilous and a little unusual.
So we'll definitely get to talking about American democracy at home, but just in terms of America's attitude towards upholding democracy abroad during the past couple of decades, especially, you know, following the promise that we had achieved, you know, peak liberalization, peak democratization across the world. What efforts has America made during this time of democratic backsliding across the world to strengthen democracies?
Well, starting in the 1980s, America pledged itself to the idea of something like democracy promotion. So when you look at an institution like the National Endowment for Democracy, it was a bipartisan effort to support civil society organizations and certain kinds of political organizations in other countries that could help to strengthen the democratic opposition in some autocracies insofar as feasible, and to strengthen civil society, which was thought to be a big cause of the stabilization of democracy to develop. So that is one example of how America has invested real money in giving the resources that civil society organizations, media organizations, and sometimes political activists needed in order to do their work. More controversially and you could say more misguidedly, there have also been one or two attempts to establish democratic institutions by force. So in particular, in the Iraq War, the hope, and I think it's worth trying to understand why this seemed like a genuinely appealing vision to many people at the time, was to say that there's no real democracy in the Middle East. There's this terrible dictator in Iraq who has killed a lot of his own citizens, invaded another country, continues to pose a security problem. And wouldn't it be great if we are able to go in there, replace this dictator with a thriving democracy? And this would not only give a lot of freedom and liberty to the people of Iraq, it would also create the shining model that other Middle Eastern countries might follow for how to build this modern democracy and the kind of benefits it's going to have to people. This is a hopeful vision for the Middle East, which rejected a lot of the xenophobic or perhaps you might say racist ideas which claimed that for various regions the Middle East just wasn't ready for democracy. So it was actually a very appealing vision. But as we learned throughout the 2000s, it was also a misguided vision because a country that is as deeply split along sectarian lines as Iraq, but has as little a history of democracy, and in which the democratic movement did not succeed on its own domestic turf, but was imposed through an occupation with all the trauma that comes with it, just isn't very likely to succeed or at least to thrive. And so when you're talking about what the United States has done to try and fortify or spread democracy, I think there are good cases of how the National Endowment of Democracy and other organizations have, in fact, help to strengthen civil society in some countries and help democratic institutions thrive. But there's also, I think, the really failed case of Iraq, in which the thinking was that the United States and its allies could come in, depose a terrible dictator, who really was terrible, and create a thriving democratic system. But the democratic system in Iraq did not turn out to be very thriving, and the cost that the country and the United States paid for it was far too high.
So, you know, you've already started to touch on this, but the American effort in Iraq, as well as other like American efforts in foreign affairs, has earned America over the years the critique that it plays the quote unquote world's policeman in terms of interfering with countries' affairs that some people critique that it shouldn't necessarily interfere with. But again, as you said, some American efforts to uphold democracy abroad have been successful, whereas, of course, others, such as the Iraq War, were not. So, in your opinion, are American efforts to maintain democracy abroad worth sustaining this critique of our foreign policy?
Well, I think it depends. I think it depends on which efforts you're talking about and what the goal of them is. I think certainly we have learned that the attempt to impose democracy by force can only work under very extraordinary circumstances. It did work in Japan and Germany after World War II. So we can't say that it never works. But those were extraordinary circumstances, in part because those countries had really started World War II, and there was some recognition within their populations of the disaster which they themselves and their previous political regimes had caused. So the first lesson, I think, is don't do it by force unless you're talking about very extraordinary circumstances. The second lesson, which I've been advocating recently in articles in Foreign Affairs and elsewhere, is that the paradigm of democracy promotion was appropriate to a time period in which democracy was expanding, right? When you have a sense that the world is moving towards more democracy and perhaps you can do something to speed that process up, or you can do something to make sure that process reaches further than it might otherwise, it feels natural to try and do democracy promotion. Now we are in a deep democratic recession. We see democracy imperiled in many countries around the world and even at home. And so I think the more appropriate framework is democracy protection. We should think less about how to bring democracy to countries that now don't have democratic institutions, and more about how to protect democratic institutions against authoritarian attempts to undermine them in countries from Brazil to the Philippines to Turkey to Hungary and Poland. The question of a world policeman, I think, is slightly separate, right? One question is democracy a better political system than the alternatives? And should the United States, insofar as possible, help to encourage the formation of these democratic institutions? And that depends in part on who you think you owe moral consideration to. A lot of the arguments against this are a form of moral relativism in which we're saying, don't interfere with the dictator in this country or the dictator in that country. And it's framed as forward as a respect for other people, but those people don't actually get to make decisions. They are living under the thrall of an authoritarian power that makes sure that their desires are not listened to. So I worry a lot about the practicality of this. I don't worry that there's something morally wrong with helping people in other countries have the ability to determine their own fate rather than living under the subjection of a dictator. So that's one kind of question. But the other kind of question is about the world policeman, which I think is less about spreading democracy and more about what is sometimes called the liberal international order, somewhat terrible, not very attractive term. But that covers very important things. That covers, for example, the very important international norm that countries should not try to expand the territory through war and conquest. And we're now seeing Russia threaten to do so in Ukraine. And I think, ideally, a lot of countries would be part of being the world policeman. Ideally, a lot of countries would recognize the importance of making sure that people don't cause conflict in this way, don't try to expand the territory in this way. But when you look at the current international situation, the United States remains the only very significant power that is committed to these kinds of principles and ideals. And so I think there's nothing wrong in itself with the aspiration of saying, if nobody else is going to do it, we're going to do it, and we're going to try and make sure that we uphold norms like the idea that you cannot expand your territory through military conquest as best we can. What that means in each particular situation, what that means for, what Joe Biden and Antony Blinken and Jake Sullivan should do with regard to Russia right now is a very complicated question. But the aspiration that it's in the interest of the United States and in the interest of everybody in the world to make sure that dictators like Vladimir Putin can't start wars with the goal of expanding their territory should, I think, be uncontroversial.
And Professor, on this very topic of America's role in promoting the liberal world order, I remember one of the major concerns during the Trump administration and in the 2020 American presidential elections was Donald Trump's influence on the state of democracy around the world. So could you kind of tell us or walk us through how did Trump's time in office change the trajectory of global democracy, if it did at all?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it's not an easy question to answer. I think the most important effect that Trump had was simply on democracy in the United States. The United States is not the most populous democracy in the world. India, for example, is more populous. But it's probably not even the richest democracy in the world per capita. I think, for example, that Switzerland probably has more income per capita. But it is by far and away, well, first of all, it's arguably the oldest, or probably the oldest democracy in the world. Secondly, it is the culturally most influential one. Thirdly, it does have the biggest economy. And fourth, it has by far and away the biggest military. And so, you know, the fate and the image, so the fate of the United States is important simply because if you care about democracy thriving, the success of it in this particular country is incredibly important. And Donald Trump clearly, I think, was a threat to the democratic institutions in the United States. So that is by far and away the most important impact, just what he did to democratic institutions in the United States themselves. There's a second influence it had, which I think is significant, which is on the image of democracy around the world. It's telling, for example, a student told me this, so I never researched it myself. I may be wrong. I'm relying on a Hopkins student here. So if I'm wrong, you can blame your fellow classmate. That 2016 was the first time that Iran broadcast live an American presidential campaign, an American presidential debate, because they thought that seeing the spectacle of how Trump comported himself would in fact help to undermine democratic aspirations within Iran. That, I think, is a very interesting little data point. And it's certainly true that in many autocratic countries around the world and in some countries with struggling democracies, looking at both the nature and the comportment of President Trump and at the deep division that America is now experiencing is a very effective argument against democracy. And that, I think, hurts the cause of global democracy. The third argument would be that Donald Trump was, in many cases, allied with autocratic leaders or with authoritarian challengers to democratic institutions, that he was very close with General al-Sisi in Egypt, that he even had good words to say about Kim Jong-un in North Korea, that in a country like Poland, he was on the side of the government, which is really trying to undermine key democratic institutions like the free press, like the judiciary, rather than on the side of its opponents. I think that third argument is probably the weakest. It is certainly concerning that Trump was on the side of these dictators, that he was on the side of these autocratic challenges to democratic institutions. But it's not clear to me how much of a difference that actually made in practice.
And moving from the Trump administration to Biden, I know that now President Joe Biden, but when he was campaigning, he emphasized, you know, the importance of preserving democratic values and democracy around the world. And part of it probably was due to what we saw happening during the Trump administration. So I know it's only been a year in office, and I wanted to ask you, first, what specific strategies did Biden and his administration want to employ? And based on this year, and it might not be a lot, does it look like they're going to fulfill their promises that they made?
Well, I don't know that they ever outlined any very specific strategies, but Joe Biden certainly talked a lot during his campaign, not just about wanting to save the soul of America and saving democratic institutions in the United States, but also making sure that America helps in the global fight between democracy and autocracy. That this administration makes a real contribution in ensuring that the global fight for democracy can succeed over the next years. That rhetoric was always a little bit more lofty and highfalutin than any practical suggestions for how to accomplish it. The most concrete promise was for a global summit of democracies, which was supposed to reinvigorate the alliance between democratic countries, renew the democratic spirit around the world. But relatively quickly, I think, the Biden administration realized that this promise had turned into a little bit of a liability and a little bit of potentially an embarrassment. They faced difficult decisions as to which countries to invite. Very important countries like India and Brazil are currently ruled by authoritarian populists who are really undermining democratic institutions there. It would look a little strange to invite Mr. Modi to come talk about the importance of democracy when he is an acute threat to democracy and the most populist democracy in the world. But at the same time, it would also look strange not to invite the most populist democracy in the world, and one that, for various geostrategic reasons, the United States has an interest in having close cooperation with, even if you care about containing an autocratic government like China. So even from the point of view of democracy, not inviting that country would be a liability as well. And so the administration came up with a face-saving set of compromises which succeeded in averting the worst embarrassment, but did not succeed in accomplishing very much. They held a two-day summit on Zoom, which they called the Summit for Democracy rather than Summit of Democracies. The administration made a few promises about how to contain money laundering and have a few other anti-corruption metrics and help fund legal defenses for democracy activists who are facing spurious defamation lawsuits. And there's a couple of perfectly sensible measures there. But I don't think anybody believes that this summit was a real turning point in terms of coordinating different nations around the world to double down on their determination to save democracy in this moment of global power. So a little over a year now into the Biden administration, I've been disappointed by what they've been able to do in this field. For I also recognize that it's incredibly difficult to know exactly what to do and how to do it. It's very difficult to find policy solutions in this particular area. So I recognize that they are facing a tough challenge, and that this challenge is made tougher by the crises that we've seen in Afghanistan, by the crisis we're now seeing in Ukraine. Nevertheless, it's hard to escape the conclusion that the lofty rhetoric that Joe Biden embraced during his campaign and during the early months of his presidency did not translate into any particularly significant action.
And on that same topic, it does seem like to me that the administration really did limit itself to a lot of criticisms on its policy, or a lot of criticisms along the lines of its policy. So, for example, criticizing violations of the rule of law, human rights. And like you said at the end there, it didn't seem like they took that much action to back up their criticisms. And so I guess my question is, are there any actions or potential actions that the U.S. can take in order to strengthen its position and be more than just criticisms?
No, I do think that there are things that the United States can do. One of them would be to make clear that there is a level of partnership which we reserve for governments that respect democratic institutions and the rights of their citizens. The nature of geopolitics is such that we'll always have to coordinate to some extent with countries that are not democracies. And we obviously have to have diplomacy and talks even with some autocratic governments that do really quite terrible things to their own people, given the nature of the international system, the nature of the United Nations and who sits on the Security Council, the nature of some global goals like the fight against terrorism, that is just necessary, and we need to recognize that. But nevertheless, the extent to which countries with whom we cooperate respect human rights and institute democratic procedures should have an influence on what kind of partnership we envisage with them. And so I think if the United States clearly embrace the doctrine which said that it is going to be on the side of countries that are democracies, that it is going to be more likely to give them humanitarian aid or military aid, that would be significant. If you look at which countries we give humanitarian aid to and even which countries we give military aid to, in many cases, it is dictatorships and non-democratic regimes like Egypt, for example. And so here, I think, is an important lever that could change. A second thing we could do is to double down on our funding for free media in those countries. Part of that is to give more money to Voice of America and the other foreign language broadcasting operations, which are vital sources of information in many countries. We've wound down services in some countries where we thought there was now sufficiently free media for this no longer to be necessary. Since then, the free media in those countries has virtually disappeared. And so starting those language services up again, for example, can make a significant contribution to making sure that people in those countries get the information they need. And then third, a suggestion that I've developed over the last years is to make sure that companies and employees and citizens within the United States don't fear speaking out about the autocratic abuses of other countries. America has tied its own the hands of its own executives on bribery. Unlike some other countries, we have decided in the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, I believe it is called, that if the executive for an American company gives a bribe to somebody in another country to get some important public works program, for example, they're criminally liable for that in the United States. And this allows American executives who are asked for bribes to say, sorry, we simply cannot play on that field because we would risk going to prison in our own country. That probably leads to American companies losing out on certain deals. But I think it is, on the whole, a good thing for the world, and on the whole, also a good thing for American business. It seems to me that we should have similar legislation to protect employees within the United States in particular from being fired, from facing adverse consequences, because they speak out about human rights abuses in other countries. And that would save us from the sad spectacle, for example, of the NBA and other sports teams, many Hollywood studios, punishing employees, punishing players, punishing celebrities even, who say the truth about the human rights abuses in some other countries that have big capital markets.
So I'd like to come back to talking about American democracy at home. And one could argue that before we focus our efforts and actions on upholding democracy abroad, the U.S. government should work to secure democracy at home. As you know, there are several indicators that democracy is on the decline in America. You know, confidence in democracy is on the decline right now, and distrust between the two parties is an all-time high, as just two indicators. So in your opinion, do you think that Biden should be more focused on maintaining American democracy at home before aiming for global democracy?
Well, I don't think that it's either or, and I don't think that Biden is actually doing very much to spread democracy around the world in any case. But, you know, you can walk and chew gum at the same time. It's not clear to me, you know, why the moment of peril for democracy in the United States should be a reason not to try and support our allies in other countries that face real authoritarian challenges of their own. Often when different people are in peril, mutual aid is a pretty good strategy. When it comes to democracy at home, though, I suppose I have gotten a little bit skeptical that thinking and talking too much about it is the best way to protect it either. I mean, the single best way to protect democracy in the United States is to make sure that somebody like Donald Trump is not capable of winning elections in 2024. And the best way to make sure that somebody like Donald Trump is not able to win elections in 2024 is not to hold high-minded lectures about democracy, something that I've certainly been guilty of in the past and shall continue to be guilty of, but my job is as a writer and as a journalist and an academic. The best way of doing that is to improve your approval ratings, which means looking out for the economy, which means coming up with a cultural vision for this country that a majority of Americans can embrace, which means criticizing some of the craziness and lunacy on the other side, but also being willing to stand up to some of the crazier or loonier ideas on your own side. It means doing all the things that you need in order to be electorally competitive. And part of it, of course, also is to make sure that the elections are free and fair in 2024, to make sure in particular that the process of certifying elections is not politicized to such an extent that we might end up in a genuine constitutional crisis. I absolutely recognize the risk that Joe Biden might be legitimately reelected as president in 2024, but the election could somehow be undermined or stolen. And it is scary that we're at that point. But the biggest risk I see right now is that somebody like Donald Trump could win the elections fair and square and then have another 4 years in office to undermine our democratic institutions. And so I hope that minds in the White House are focused on combating that danger.
And looking into the future, the growth of populism and authoritarianism from Eastern Europe all the way to South Asia is currently one of the major threats to democratic countries. I wonder, how do you see this tension playing out in this upcoming decade?
So we see that authoritarian populists are now in power in a very large number of democracies, in Brazil, in India, in Turkey, in Poland, in many other major countries around the world. And I think that the fates may start to bifurcate. So you may start to see some of them really consolidating the power, turning countries that were democracies into dictatorships that pretend to have elections every now and again, but are really ruled by one person, or usually one man. But you might also start to see some of these less consolidated, I suppose, dictatorships starting to fall. We've seen in the pandemic that a good number of people around the world have remembered the importance of good governance, are quite displeased with governments that have failed to protect them against this serious illness. We are seeing that the longer populist leaders are in office, the more corrupt they become and the more evident the corruption becomes. And this often leads to crises of populist legitimacy. And so I think in many countries, either the populists will embrace a fully authoritarian path and manage to quash dissent, or they will start to lose some elections. So I could imagine that when you look at the large number of countries now that have had these authoritarian populist leaders for a number of years, some of them will veer back towards more democratic territory and will see real improvements. But a good number of them also will become more authoritarian, will leave even less freedom of speech, even less respect for human rights for its citizens. And it is, of course, difficult to predict, as political science always find it difficult to predict just about everything, which country will go in which direction. I think there'll be some surprises there.
And so based on your analysis then, should the American policy on, fighting for and progressing democracy over authoritarianism, should that be one of trying to contain authoritarianism where we see it? Or do you think that we should more pursue coexistence and trying to live with the fact that some countries are going to be authoritarian?
Well, those two things aren't mutually exclusive. We've always lived in a world in which some countries were authoritarian, and unless the next 10 years go much, much better than I imagine, we will continue to live with lots of countries that are authoritarian. And there are some areas where we have to be willing to cooperate with those. In the UN Security Council, there will be permanent members who are authoritarian for the foreseeable future. And there are important issues of security, important issues of avoiding war or even a nuclear conflagration around the world, which we obviously have to have very close contact with them and try as best as we can to cooperate with them. At the same time, I think the United States should also recognize that both for normative reasons, both because of the things we care about in the world, like the respect for human rights, like the ability of people to determine their own fate, we should try to encourage democracy where we can. And we should recognize that in the long run, our security, our values, our ability to live as we wish will be seriously undermined if virtually every other country in the world starts to be a dictatorship. And so I think we have both high-minded and selfish reasons to make sure that we protect democracies around the world. And sure, where possible, in those rare cases where we can make a contribution to help other countries consolidate new democratic institutions, do that as well. So again, you know, absolutely, we will have to live in a world system with lots of autocracies for the foreseeable future. But it is nevertheless very important for us to help protect our democratic allies against autocratic takeover.
Professor Monk, thank you so much for joining us today for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much, Julia and Indy.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. We hope you enjoyed it. We would like to say thank you to the International Studies Program at Johns Hopkins University and the SNF Agora Institute at Johns Hopkins University for making this episode possible. Remember to follow us on social media at HopkinsPOFA on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for the latest and greatest of Hopkins POFA content. Hit follow on Spotify, subscribe on iTunes, and leave a rating. We'll see you next time.